Welcome to Thursday. My name is Mark Farrell. The show is Insight on the Progressive Radio Network. Go Houston Astros! Fabulous. Congratulations to them. Game 7, decisive Game 7 last night. 5-1? Woo! Man, unbelievable. First time in our franchise history. Now, things like that, when that happens in sport, it just makes me happy for the team, the victorious team, because that's what sport's all about. I mean, obviously, we know that usually the money teams and franchises are the teams that win most notably and often. And so, of course, a team like Houston's been good, you know, sporadically, but they don't have the all-time, the big money players, et cetera, et cetera. So it's really good to see a team like that come through in a big way. Oh, we got a great show coming to you today. As a matter of fact, I need to stop talking so we can get to it. You're going to meet an incredible writer named Kirsten Corley. She's a writer for Thought Catalog. She's purchased that. Yeah, she did purchase her own book, but probably not. But she published her own book, But Before You Leave, a book of poetry about experiences that we struggle to put into words, all of us, every day, and she's done it for us. And it's a quite incredible and profound, poignant book. And we're going to meet Kirsten in just a few minutes. But I want to talk to you about a few things. Going back to the baseball introductory, Houston Astros, reminds me of, well, I always wanted to play baseball as a kid. And I actually did, but unsuccessfully, because PRN listeners of Insight know I have a visual impairment. So permitted me not really to partake in baseball as a kid. But when I was in Little League, because my mother thought, of course, assimilate the kid, give him a normal environment. And I did. And I was horrible. I was horrible. I can't put it any other way because I couldn't see the freaking ball. Of course, you should put a kid who's visually impaired where? In the outfield. So I would hear a crack. And I'd hear, that would be a thud. Behind you. To your right. No, your other right. And I would be scrambling for the ball. So I'd find the ball, and I didn't know where the runner was because it was hard to see. So I usually would take a chance and go to second or first or whatever. So it was bad. But I do have one particular memory where it was, I guess, the end of the season. And here we are. Tie score. I guess we're top of seventh. I'm not sure. All I know is it was just Marcus up at bat. Oh, no. It was two outs, and I'm up at bat. I could see everyone in the bench, even the coach, just starting to fold over like their caps were being pulled down. It's like, oh, let's just start the cars. Parents, just go get your kids. Like, it was all over with. And I got up to bat, and I don't remember the exact count. I think I had a few foul tips. But I got on a base, and for me, that was my World Series. That was incredible. I remember going to Boston that weekend because I had a sibling living there who still lives there, and we flew up there, and I was on cloud nine the whole weekend because my ability to get on base was allowed us to win a game because someone else either put me to second and drove me home or whatever, but we won, and that was something that, you know, crystallizes the significance of sports in a good way and bad way, because obviously if I was struck out, I would still remember that story, but in a much darker light. Now, flash forward to like 30 years later. Can I say 30 years? Maybe 40. 35 years. Okay. Two years ago, my friend is playing softball, indoor softball, and I was busting his chops. I'm like, hey, you didn't ask me to play. He's like, do you want to? Oh, I know, you know, with your eyes. I'm like, you know what? I always wanted to, but, you know, I'm just scared. So he's like, well, listen, come try out. I'm like, no, forget this tryout crap. I mean, I'll come over to your house because he's organizing the team. So let's throw a few balls because, believe it or not, his name's Joe. I'm like, Joe, I'm a good pitcher because I'm, you know, some people have that innate ability to just have good aim. I'm one of those people. I don't know what it is. You're just wired that way. Just like, who knows? So I go over his house and I'm like, bam, 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 bam. And, you know, it's softball. It's not overhand. And he's like, Mark, that's perfect. That's great. I'm like, listen, don't blow any smoke. Really, tell me the truth. My kid's there too. He's like, Mark, I'm telling you. Fine, you can do it. You should come on a team. So I did it. So I was really, really happy. But the only thing I was very scared about was striking out, which I did often in Little League. So all these memories, it's amazing. They just come flooding back to you like it was a week ago or a month ago or a year ago. So that night, indoor softball, again, never heard of it. It's a huge dome. couldn't be on a team with nicer guys, all professionals, you know, parents, nice guys. So I start on the mound. And let me tell you something. I was completely and utterly scared beyond imagination. Out of my mind, my wits, my knees were knocking, everything. But I looked cool as a cucumber because I told my buddy and a few other people later, and they're like, we never would have known. I was completely scared. And not only was I scared about obviously pitching the ball, I was more intimidated about catching the ball when they threw it back to me. That's what I had the problem with. And I dropped it maybe a handful of times, but, you know, that can happen during for any pitcher. So first game went pretty well, and I remember going to my friend afterwards saying, what happened? He's like, what do you mean what happened? I was in such like a remove state, like an outer body state. It was almost like I had an amnesia. I'm like, well, what happened? I mean, he said, you did. I know I did okay, right? He's like, no, you did really well. And I think I got on base or maybe popped out or something. But the more important thing was on the mound, my performance. And I was just so intimidated, frightened, kind of exhilarated as well. But that didn't come out until afterwards, until I allowed myself to breathe. And this is a transferable experience for everybody in their life, whether it's feeling like you don't have the chops to be in radio, to be a mathematician, to be a psychologist, to be a physician, to drive, to get your articulator's license, to operate an 18-wheeler, whatever the case may be, we all have that little voice. Whether it's validated through a disability or maybe some pitfalls or shortfalls in your life, you know, it can happen. So there I was on the mound, but I was okay. So let's fast forward to game two. So I tell my wife all this, and she's like, wow. So the next game, I think like the first or second batter up, I get a direct hit to my face. And I was able to get just a piece of the glove up to block it. But I had a little bit of a shiner on the side. So that kind of like, you know, freaked me out a little bit because I was saying to myself, well, here's what I signed up for. And it's very, very common for pitchers to get beamed. Of course, even the pros, they just have to recover because their reach is so deep and far. The hardest thing for them is to get their arms back and to get their other foot down in time to prevent that ball from obviously taking their head off. So it got me rattled, but I said, that's all right. You know, this is what I'm here for. This is part of the game. This is sport. I'm doing okay. Then after that game, my friend had said to me, you know, he spoke to the league and told them about my condition and said they're certainly willing and it's acceptable, permissible to put up one of those nets. I guess a lot of the pro teams and maybe college and high school, I don't know, I never go to a game or practice, have these nets in front of pitchers to prevent a unnecessary injury for a pitcher. And I considered it for about 2 seconds. And you know why I didn't take it and accept it? Because I felt like it would make me different. And my whole life I've been different. And I didn't want this to be an apparent, like my disability is an invisible disability, but that would make it a visible, obvious disability. Everyone would be like, well, why does that pitcher have a net in front of him? You know? So I declined it. I'm like, hey, Joe, thank you very much. It was very cool. I really applauded my friend more because he's a really humble, kind of quiet guy. I thanked him profusely, but in my mind, I'm like, wow, what a good friend that he went to the league and did all this inquiry on my behalf and, you know, for my safety. And I really appreciate that. And we all have people who go to bat for us. And sometimes we don't know about that. And whether it's a colleague, but it's fantastic to know that people are out there. So anyway, the reality is I had a great time and I lived out almost like a childhood fantasy of doing well in a league. I'd say I pitched every game, if not the whole game, 3/4 of the game each time. So it was a really great experience, and I'll never forget it. Unfortunately, we didn't do it again after that season, which was about 2 years ago, I believe, because of they really increased the rates, and it wasn't warranted anyway. We didn't go back there. So, but I would love to do it again, and it just goes to the point that if there's something that you've always wanted to do. And our guest that you're going to meet in a few minutes is doing something that she loves to do when she's not having her pen to the page, when her fingers are not gracing the keyboard and coming out with incredible wisdom and sentences and sharing personal stories and insights. She puts her feet to the pavement and does what she loves to do, as well as changing the community by helping one person at a time. So on Monday, of course, we heard about everything. The ripples of this New York City story went worldwide. The truck terrorist attack, you know, is it a complete surprise? Absolutely not. The fact that 8 lives were lost, complete shame. And 12 injuries, it's a miracle that it wasn't more. And when I think about this, I've worked in New York City my entire professional life, and actually starting as an intern since 88 in college. So I've been here all my life, raised next door in New Jersey. For our international listeners, that's just a stone's throw across the river. And it's a great place to work. It's the capital of the world on so many different levels. And when we think about risk, we all take risk, obviously, working in a city that has millions and millions of people. I forget what the local or the most, valid count, accurate count was. I think it's like, is it 10 million a day during the day? I think it goes down to like maybe 4 million a night, 3 million a night in terms of residents. So there is a shitload of people here. And obviously there's casualties on many levels because of just injuries, car accidents, fatalities, trains, et cetera, et cetera. But obviously this is a whole different conversation since 2001, 9/11. I'm just frankly really, really surprised. And we all think this, and a lot of us say it, but I think we more think it than articulate it, that something like this caliber doesn't happen more frequently and more often. And to be quite candid, to a larger degree. I like to think that it's because we do such a fine job vetting people and having good community ties to Muslim neighborhoods and communities and doing all the due diligence. I think that's the bulk of it. And then I think there's this another percentage that comes down to luck. And then I think it's just the other percentage, I hope it's really, really small, is timing. That a democracy that we live in, it's impossible. It's impossible for it to be prevented in my hometown, your hometown, the city of New York, Boston we've seen. I mean, you know, countless. When we think about all the, there was a shooting last night in Walmart in Wisconsin, was that? I can't remember the city. And this is a gunman at large, went in, shot 3 people. Now, we're talking about different attacks here and different laws. But going back to Monday's attack, I was very, very pleased to see that the Halloween parade went on with over 1 million attendees. That's the New York City spirit. Not to be intimidated, to be resilient. Of course, I'm sure a lot of people were, thinking twice, looking over the shoulder. But see, that's our best weapon of defense. That is where we are the strongest allies of ourselves, to have the eyes and ears, to call 9/11, to report anything. That is where I think we will be most successful, because the response teams and their tactical units and everything are incredible. I mean, there's not one person, you know, usually if something didn't go that great, there's always one person in a force or in the government politician would say, well, you know, it went pretty well, but, you know, Mark Farrell's team just wasn't there enough, or the SWAT team wasn't, you know. So all across the board, the response team is amazing. It's a well-oiled machine. I think we have one of the finest police departments in the world from all the reading I've done, compared to some incredible, incredible cities faced with adverse conditions. And it's great. That's a good feeling to know. That gives me peace, sense of peace, and knowing that if there is something that goes down here, the response time is very, very rapid. And of course, you know, reactionary, you know, being a New Yorker, unfortunately, I've gotten myself into a few situations, and it's too long to go into right now, where I'd say about 5 or 7 times on the streets of New York City, I've just instinctively gotten involved with somebody who was getting mugged, someone who gotten their purse snatched, somebody who was getting beaten up. I've stepped in and helped out several times. And looking back, some of the times, instances I should not have, because it was just too dangerous, but I did. And I look back and I'm like, whoa, you know, maybe I shouldn't have done that. But just that's how people are wired. And that's how I think how cities and countries will overall, you know, remain safe and keep the fatalities, tragedies, and instances of terrorist attacks hopefully to a minimum. And of course, Trump, you know, right away goes to blame, of course, instead of consoling a nation and trying to pacify and unite. He blamed the Democrats right away. Well, it's the Democrats, blah, 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 blah. And of course, he's pushing for the death penalty. I don't have a problem for that, because if you come into our country, however, legally, illegally, and you kill people, I'm sorry, that's it. End of story. Close the book. Done. You may not agree with that, and that's fine, but that's my perspective. But just that, you know, that we're hardy and resilient here, and we're going to do what it takes. And I have to share a quick story for you with you. Before we get to my guest, because my mother was the has been involved with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention for 25 years after her son, my brother, died by suicide. And she is the chair of New Jersey. Long story short, her information is on a website, et cetera, et cetera. She gets a call yesterday from a gentleman who probably sounded middle-aged, saying that he was going to take his life and that he wanted help. She immediately took action and said, I'm sorry, this is not a hotline. Can I have your name and number? And of course, he just, you know, bugged out and hung up the phone. So my mother, who is not a spry chicken, incredibly spry for her age, but someone who obviously does a good job, but she was freaked out. That would rattle anybody. So she called me right away, and I tried to walk her through the steps of how to go through her phone and find the numbers. And she actually got somebody in her apartment and took pictures of the phone and sent me. And we went through. We could not locate the number. The numbers that I did find, I called, and there was one person I spoke with, and it wasn't them. Long story short, it was a very, very frustrating situation. And I can't imagine, when I think about like first responders, or when you have a situation like this that's so timely and so critical, the people doing their best to console somebody, but that also making the wheels turn, whether it's getting the police or the phone companies to ping that phone, or on so many different levels, car manufacturer, security firms to open a house, open a door, locate a car, person. There's so many different instances. And you think about the web, the network that we can use to track people down, but yet, during a simple phone call that was placed, I'm hoping that the person wasn't in dire needs. And if they were, they realized that they needed to go to a walk-in emergency room, which my mother immediately articulated to the caller. Anyway, so we never want that to get to that certainly level, because we want, when I speak to schools about mental health, we give them the tools. I give them the tools. So if they ever know or experience like, wow, I just don't feel right, or my thoughts are not right, I'm not feeling like the same person, things are different for me, then they'll realize, oh, okay, yeah, I remember reading about it. I remember hearing. I remember somebody sharing stories with me that this could possibly be a potential characteristic that I could experience in my lifetime, and I'm only a teenager, and why is this happening to me? But the tools are there, just like, you know, calculus and science or whatever the case may be. We have to give our kids, students, our youth, the tools, the ammunition to know. I mean, information is power, and there's nothing more powerful than having the knowledge of yourself. I mean, I always say to people when I speak at events, as a matter of fact, I spoke at, where was I? In a town about 4 months ago, and there was all doctors. Three or four panels were doctors and myself, all on perspective, being resilient, with mental illness, et cetera. And I introduced myself and I said, I'm the only one on this, at this table without an initial after my name, but I am an expert. And I paused, I gave a long pause for the audience members to kind of like, you know, realize and or think about, well, why is this guy an expert? I said, I'm an expert in me, because all I've lived through, all I've experienced, good, bad, and different, that I know myself better than any doctor or professional. I could articulate everything I feel, because no one knows you like you know you. And I said to them, by the end of today, by the end of next month, by the end of the next year, you need to be an expert in you. And I went on, and I have logical statements to follow that up. But it's interesting how That's how it comes down to, because when those talks are just very, very vital. So the crux of it is that hopefully, you know, anyone in your life that you ever come across, whether it's a friend, acquaintance, family member, colleague, that ever feels like they're in dire situation, that they know what they have to do, because letting it get to that point is just not a good thing. And very quickly, I just want to mention that all these sexual assaults that have come out in the news, I really, really applaud people for coming forward. You know, last week, I guess, someone came out against Kevin Spacey, and I think just yesterday, Dustin Hoffman was accused by, is it Randy Quaid? I think Randy Quaid. Something like that. Okay, I don't want to... I don't want to mess up the Quaids. Dennis Quaid is the older one. Anyway, something happened, and it's amazing how this is coming out of the woodwork. And I just want to hit the pause button for a second, because I don't want to like lighten the situation, but I got to lighten the situation. It's actually very funny. I bet you there's got to be like a bet on Wall Street, because you know Wall Street bets on everything. That, okay, you know, well, we know the Partridges, one of them were abused, or no, was it Mr. Brady? What's his name? Yeah, he did something. But it's just amazing. Like, I'll bet, God, who can I think of? Lucille Ball, more current, some show, some actors. Like, they must be having a pool of some caliber, because it's like, it's unbelievable how many people are coming out. And I believe every single one of them. All these people that, I mean, known people that are credible, because I think that this is very, very cathartic, and I think it's empowering people. And yes, I just made fun of it, because that's what I do. I'm an entertainment, right? But I'm not making fun of their claims. I'm making fun of just the sheer number of people, because the Harvey Weinsteins in the world are everywhere. They're ubiquitous. It's unfortunate, but they're everywhere. And it's men 90% of the time who are the conquerors that do this unwarranted and are breaking the law because they have a position of power and prestige and money. All comes down to that, which is just the bullet word power. And I really applaud all these people. And for you, if this has ever been something you've ever experienced, I think we've probably all known somebody in college, when we were in college or in school, that got raped. And that's probably reflective of maybe the smaller percentage of the people, or larger percentage, I should say, that have been raped that don't say anything. And I get it. I understand it. It's a fearful thing. But to live with that PTSD, as a matter of fact, the timeliness of the show, Ray Donovan, the season finale was on last week. And he, of course, this is fiction. It's a TV show on Showtime. Great season. I think it's like the fifth or sixth season. They just signed up for another season. That he and one of his brothers were sexually abused by, wow, what an anomaly, a priest. And he is still dealing with this. And it came to the forefront, to the surface. And he dealt with it in the, I won't have a spoiler alert. Don't worry about that. But he's dealing with it in a very, very, very unhealthy way. Anyway, so that's all I had to say. So it's just great that people are empowered, because life is short, man. Life is short. And to deal with something that you had no control over, or even if you did, but just to make it right, because it just kind of quashing it down with alcohol or medication or reckless behavior is never going to help. So, that's not too heavy, is it? The show is Insight. My name is Mark Farrell, trying to make it light for you. 25 minutes past the hour of 11 o'clock, live in Midtown Manhattan. And it gives me a great pleasure to introduce Kirsten Corley. The young age of 25. My God, I remember when I was 25. She's written for the Huffington Post, Elite, Daily, Mogul, and many others on relationship, lifestyle, mental health, awareness, and many, many more. And in March 2017, her first book hit the shelves, But Before You Go. Kirsten, welcome to the show, my dear.
Thank you very much for having me, Mark. How are you today?
This is a huge, huge weekend for you.
Yes, yeah. I have the New York Full Marathon coming up.
That's
so I'm
right.
I'm very excited about it.
I am so impressed with you on many, many levels. And listeners are really going to get to know you and appreciate you because of your open bookness of your life. You too, like myself, have experienced and suffer from anxiety and depression. Very, very fun things to have in life, right?
Yeah, I would say, you know, I got into the industry and one of the first articles I wrote was about anxiety disorder. And I realized
Were you still in college back then?
No, this was my first year graduating. So this was probably 3 months into graduating. And I wrote an article, what anxiety actually is. And that was to me, you know, what anxiety meant to me. And I saw it go viral. And then I began to do a lot more research.
Was that anonymous when you wrote that?
No. I wrote it with Elite Daily and I wrote it under my name. I kind of went into this industry thinking, if I'm going to sell something, I'm going to sell myself and I'm going to sell my stories and the things I've experienced.
And the things you know best because you're an expert in you.
Yes. So I began writing a lot more about mental health awareness and just kind of made it my life in the past 3 years.
Kirsten, when you wrote that, was it something that you had done before writing about your anxiety, obviously like in a journal or something to that equivalence, or did you write it with a whole different tone and direction that was meant for people to read? And of course, you wouldn't embellish, but it was just written in a different perspective because you knew you wanted people to understand really the core of who you are and what you were experiencing.
For me, I just kind of went down a list of what are some of the things you worry about? What are some of your daily struggles? What are some of the things that put you over the edge? And wrote that in probably a 2-page article. And so for me, it was just trying to take my own experience and put it out there. So I wasn't really writing for an audience as much as I was trying to understand my own experience.
When you hit that send button, tell me how you felt.
It was nerve-wracking because I didn't know if it would get approved. I didn't know what would happen. You know, there's no guarantees at the time.
Were you an open book back then with your employer and or?
No, you know, I was learning the industry. I was learning what worked. I was learning what didn't. So I wrote this article and then suddenly I started getting a million notifications across social media and I was like, all right, this is a button I should keep pushing because this is something people resonate with.
Oh, absolutely. It's so ubiquitous. I mean, how many people do we all know that suffer some form of mental illness? So was the first validation back from your publisher or editor saying, Kirsten, this is great?
It wasn't so much that. It was just like, all right, this is all over the internet now. So,
So it was so that just, happened first.
Yeah, it was just all over Facebook all of a sudden. And I was like, okay, you know, I remember sitting there with a friend of mine and I said, you know, I'm kind of scared of how quickly this has taken off. And I said, but
how
it scares
was
me.
It?
It took off. It was, I published it, I think, in December. And it hung for about 3 months of just all over the internet. And I said, you know, it scares me enough to know I'm doing the right thing in my life right now.
Talk about that fear. Was it a ambivalent fear?
I think it was more of a fear of what am I getting into and do I want to keep doing this? Because here I am now putting, I would say maybe a target on my back and suddenly being the face to this big issue that is so much bigger than me.
But what would be the worst thing, and believe me, I totally understand how you feel, but what would be the worst thing for being that face? Was it something that you felt like you lost your anonymity for or something that you felt like you couldn't live up to?
I would say just trying to, you know, clearly articulate this to the best of my own ability, but hoping that people could relate to it. You know, you have an audience and sometimes people are going to say, I have anxiety disorder, but I don't deal with that. I have depression, but I don't deal with it that way. I don't have that type of thing. So, you know, I'm taking my own experiences, but it doesn't mean it's everyone's experience. So you're always going to have somebody going after you and saying, no, you're wrong because I deal with it this way or I have these types of issues. So, you know, you put something out there and you're not 100% right, but you're 100% right about how you perceive it yourself.
Was there a turning point when you realized that you did do the right thing and you're happy going down this trail?
I think seeing how my career took off and suddenly seeing an audience following me was the point where I was like, okay, now I have people who care about what I'm saying and are following my every move when it comes to what I'm writing down. So I think there was that moment of, okay, this is where I should be and this is the right move to have made.
Especially since you've been yearning to do this since age 9?
Yeah, you know, I didn't think I'd be internet writing. You know, I had initially started in New York working for a publishing company with books and in a sales position, and I was writing on the side. So for me, it was, I took a step back from that and I said, why don't we just pursue this completely full time?
But as a millennial, it makes complete sense. I imagine if you were 45 years old and thinking, wow, this is not the direction I thought I would go, but, you know, I'll run with it. But this is the life you grew up in.
Yeah. I mean, at the time, it seemed like leaving a job, my first job in New York, leaving it to pursue writing. You know, I said that to my parents and they looked at me like I was crazy. But, you know, at the same time, I was like, I think this is what feels right. And, you know, I'm young enough that I can make that decision and change paths. And even though it was just a slight path, it worked for me.
And that's what feels right. Let's talk about, unfortunately, what doesn't feel right. Talk about anxiety and when you first noticed it. And obviously, you couldn't put a label to it.
I dealt with it pretty much my entire life. But, you know, when you're growing up and when you're a kid, you don't really call it that. You don't call it, before I'd wake up for a soccer game, I didn't want to go because I thought if I was the goalie at the time, if I don't block the goal, it's all my fault that we lost this game. And my dad would have to sit me through, talking me through, okay, this isn't entirely your fault if something were to go wrong. Or having, when it came to relationships and friendships, you know, I'd constantly call people often. And it was just constantly calling them back. And when they wouldn't call me back, I remember getting nervous. And that was like in fifth and sixth grade, things like that. And, you know, we didn't call it anxiety. We just, for me, I just thought, okay, this is kind of, I think everybody's like this. And it took me a really long time to realize, to call it what it was. And I don't think I did until college, actually. So I went from 12 years old to 21, not really knowing what this was.
That's a long time.
Yeah. And for me, it was, once I was able to call it anxiety, it kind of started to make sense. I started understanding why you're so nervous before test, why going to a game still makes you nervous when I played volleyball throughout high school and college, and things like that, why relationships, you struggle sometimes when it comes to basic communication. So for me, being able to finally call it something was relieving in a way, because then it suddenly made me understand, like, okay, this isn't something everybody deals with every single day, but this suddenly explains why you are the way you are.
And how did you cope with it once it was labeled and identified? Were there measures that you can immediately take?
You know, it was my senior year of college, and I walked into our counseling service, and I sat down and I said, this is what we're dealing with. I need to learn how to live with this the best way I can.
And that's 4 years of dealing with incredible, stressful situations, you know?
Yeah.
Endless studying, exams. Wow.
Yeah.
A lot of pressure.
For me, it was, you know, looking back, I think it really positively affected me. You know, I was so nervous about doing well that I always made sure I overprepared. I was always nervous about maybe a game or things like that. So I always made sure I was in the best shape I could be leading up to preseason. I always overprepared out of the fear of failing, that it made me succeed.
Which a lot of people could consider you just simply a type A.
Yeah, I would definitely agree I'm type A.
Well, in terms of just being anxious, they wouldn't say, oh, she has anxiety. She suffers from anxiety disorder. She's just type A. She's, you know, got to be on top of it.
Yeah, yeah. And definitely, I think as people get to know me more, they realize this is what she kind of lives with every single day. But I think on the surface, you see somebody who's organizing events. You see somebody who's doing well at their job. You see somebody who is succeeding. And on the surface, it looks like I'm calm, cool, and collective. But underneath, you know, there's a million thoughts running through my mind.
Oh, absolutely. Your mind doesn't stop. Now, the pendulum could swing the other way, because people with anxiety feel very scared and fearful and intimidated. and kind of stuck because they question everything. They doubt their every move. Does that sound familiar as well?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's interesting because I think when it comes to big decisions, I'm very good at making the big decisions. When it comes to little choices, that's when I kind of question myself. That's when I kind of get somebody else's opinion or wonder, think of every different possible situation and what choice I could make. So when it comes to the big decisions, I'm usually pretty calm and I'm usually pretty good. When it comes to little decisions, that's when I kind of anxiety will kick in.
When did depression become part of your life?
I would say the first time I kind of realized I was depressed probably was my senior year of high school. And my mom said to me, you know, I think you're depressed. You tell a 17-year-old that, they're just going to come back at you like, no, I'm not.
Take
what
your head
off. What
exactly.
The heck are you saying? Like, you don't know what you're talking
about.
You're
just a crazy parent.
Yeah. So, you know, my response to it was very, very hostile. Mm. And my response was, if I were to say I'm depressed, that means there's something wrong with me.
And then that you may be depressed if you say you're depressed.
Yeah. And, you know, at 17 years old, I didn't want to have that label across me. I didn't want to own that. And I didn't want to think that there was something wrong with me. So for the next few years, I think I knew under the surface that I was dealing with this, but it took me a very long time to say it proudly and say, all right, this is what I'm living with. This is how I want to overcome it. But even getting to that point of saying I have anxiety, I have depression, I have bipolar disorder, whatever the issue might be, I think one of the hardest parts is just admitting it.
At any age, it seems insurmountable. And when you're a teenager, at, you know, top of your game, being a senior in high school, with the trajectory, you know, about to happen for college, about to launch yourself, I mean, there's so many feelings and thoughts and feelings of excitement and frightened feeling. So it didn't happen until your senior year in high school that you sought professional help?
I had seen one person my senior year of high school, and I completely rejected it. I said, this isn't for me. I don't have a problem.
Or is that something your parents?
My parents pushed for it. And, you know, by my senior year, it was something I walked into myself. And by the time you get to that point where you're like, okay, I might need help, that's probably the scariest walk you take is when you walk into that office and you say, I want to make an appointment. And I think that was the most nerve-wracking moments for me was just coming. It almost felt like I was coming face to face with these demons that I had been dealing with for so long.
Was it also a feeling of being defeated?
I wouldn't say.
Like give in or accept that, yes, you may have condition X, Y, or Z?
I would say maybe at 17, I would say walking into an office would say I'm accepting defeat. At 21, I was ready. You know, so I don't think that I'm at a point where I realize mental health isn't accepting defeat. It's helping yourself. And I think it's so vital to get help. I think regardless, I think everyone deals with some sort of issue of mental health throughout their life, regardless of what stages they might be going through. Everyone has a depressed stage. Everybody gets anxious sometimes. Not everybody needs help. Not everybody needs to go to a therapist.
Take medication.
Yeah, but I think it's so, so important to call it what it is and address it and not be afraid to.
So what worked for you? It was sports. It was being conditioned, moving, being very active. Was a journal something? Obviously, you love writing. It's a great outlet for anyone, regardless of how you feel. Is that what kept you glued together?
I would say that definitely, you know, I wrote in a journal from probably when I was like 10 years old to probably more recently. I haven't so much because I write every single day for the internet, so
sure.
It's hard to balance.
Yeah,
both.
Let's take a break.
But I probably have about 70 journals at my parents' house.
Have you ever gone back and read the ones when you were 10 or 14?
Yeah, and it's really interesting to see the things I was dealing with. It's interesting to see the things I was struggling with at the time. And I look back and I kind of laugh now at 25, looking back at when I was 13 dealing with something.
25, yeah.
And, you know, I think that's a big lesson people can take away is regardless of what you're dealing with right now, you're going to look back at it and you're going to realize, okay, yeah, that was tough at the time, but it kind of made you better and you learned from it and it's not the worst.
I tell people that it's made me the incredible, resilient, empathetic, compassionate, and sensitive person that I am. Because when you go through something that I used to call my demon, you know, it used to, you know, riddle me. And I knew I was always going to beat it, but I would like talk to it. Like not myself. I'd be like, you know, I'm going to win. You know, I'm just going to, you know, keep you down. You know, I was getting treatment and it was just something that way, or the beast. I think I would call it the beast or something like that. But it was just my way of addressing a part of me that I felt like was a little bit out of control, certainly at certain times that we can all relate to. And it was just kind of like put a label in or like a reality to it of some sort. Like it's almost like when I do sports sometimes or, you know, in the gym, like, you know, I can lift this or I can do this. I can go faster than this. It's the same way. I guess I would just kind of make it a little bit concrete, even though it was obviously far from concrete, more abstract. And that's kind of how I dealt with it on many levels, but that particular instance. So when did you realize that something like this, after you put this viral and you realized and accepted, okay, well, it's out there. There's my name. There's my article. The acceptance is overwhelming. And then you had job proposals. You were working for one company here in the city. Did you realize and or always want to have the ultimate goal to publish a book and write a book?
Yeah, that had always been the thing I've always wanted. You know, that's why I went into a publishing company, my first job. You know, I remember being really young and saying to my dad, I had a tough time reading, which was, I tell the people that now and they kind of shake their head and they say, oh, like, you write books, you write articles, but learning how to read was really, really hard for me. And, you know, I had a learning disability and my dad was huge on helping me. And I said, Dad, you know, I hate reading, but I love telling stories. And so for the next few years, he really tricked me into learning to love reading. And that took a very long time. So the writing aspect of my life had always been something I loved. Telling stories was always something I loved. But it took time learning to fall in love with reading. So it was kind of, it was a process. And that's something that I overcome came. So being able to sit here with a book is kind of a big deal because I remember having so many tutors growing up. I remember my dad sitting me down and going over things with me. So in a way, it's a lot bigger to me than just having written a book.
Oh, sure. It's emblematic of a lifetime of work.
Yeah.
Everything coming to fruition as well. Talk about some of the trickery that your father used to get you to be interested in reading.
There were magazines that I loved, and it was stories about, it was like a fictional story about a boy who was a half bat and a half boy, and it was called Bat Boy. And my dad said, you know, like, I can't read this story right now because I have to read this, but I want you to read it and I want you to tell me about it after. So every Sunday night it was, we would all, the whole family would go to Barnes & Noble or go somewhere and get magazines and books. And I would read the story and I would come back and I said, Dad, this is what happened this week. And so slowly it started turning into a weekly thing. And then we'd go to Barnes & Noble every single, way too often. And when I found a book I liked, he'd buy the whole series.
Oh, that's great.
And he'd be like, okay, like, let me know when you finish this series of books and we'll go buy more. So it was really trickery and, you know, teaching me that as much as I struggled with this, I can overcome it.
Sure. And that's what parenting's all about, you know, whether it's trickery, but it's doing whatever needs to be done to give your child or children the tools to succeed in addition to love.
Yes. Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
So let's talk about your new book.
Yes.
Man, it's a beautiful book.
Yeah, it's a...
But before you leave...
It's a pocket size. So what I did was I had taken...
that's the title, by the way. It's not like she's leaving right now. Kirsten's not leaving the show right now.
I had taken probably... Just started writing down quotes and everything like that.
For years, correct?
Yeah, it was about 3 years. And my boss now, I had lunch with him, and he said, what do you think of writing a book? We have a small publishing house. And I said, I pulled out this thing I just happened to be carrying around. I go, does this work? And he's like, yeah.
Sure,
like,
let's go to print.
Can I have that? And I was like, yeah, absolutely. Like, it's all yours.
Really?
And so.
That's a dream come true. I mean, yeah, how many writers wait a lifetime?
Yeah, it was really, I was like, I went to lunch with this guy, and then I came home and I said, Dad, I got a book deal. And he goes.
And I imagine he bought too.
Yeah.
And, it was a win-win lunch.
And yeah, so it was just, everything seemed to fall into place. And then that's the company I'm with now. So it all seemed to line up very well.
And that's thoughtcatalog.com is the website, which has 30 million readers a month. That's gargantuan. That's got to be one of the biggest ones on the internet, correct?
Yeah, we do. We're within, like, I want to say, don't note me on this, but I think it's like top 50.
That's big. Yeah. That's big. And so they have their own imprint division.
Yes. Yeah. So we have a books division, which is something people don't know about Thought Catalog. You know, they think it's just articles, but we have lots of books that come out every month. So it's really exciting.
Well, not to deviate too much from your book, because I want to get into your book, but it's interesting because they have different articles about relationships, obviously about mental health, and different other categories. And what's kind of neat, which I was doing research, of course, for preparing for today, is that you can actually sign up and get certain types of articles.
Oh, yeah.
Which is very, very neat.
You can sign up to, I think it's like newsletters you can get, emails every single week.
Fantastic.
And, yeah, so if you go to the website, sign your email there, you can do that. And it's a wonderful, wonderful network of different writers across the world and within our company.
Well, when you were writing in college and thinking about, okay, when I'm a professional in the world of writing, et cetera, you probably thought about self-publishing, correct?
Yes. Yeah. That's,
and here you are, you know, underneath the imprint of someone else. That's great. Fantastic.
Yeah.
So, yes, this book has an incredible way of making you want to read cover to cover, because the quotes are, wow, insightful, relatable, and eye-opening.
Yeah, my main goal was I wanted to take the concept of, you know, somehow connect relationships, mental health awareness, relationships ending, suicide prevention, and somehow combine this all into one theme. And I thought,
and that's a lot
it
to
is.
Do.
It is. So I had a book of quotes and I had all these different genres spread out throughout my room. And I said, how can I connect these? And I thought the concept of leaving, you know, the concept of, you know, it's a concept that fascinates me, whether it's relationships ending, whether it's unfortunately if someone were to pass away, unfortunately, if you lose somebody in your life, you know, so I thought that is the common bridge between all of these is learning how to cope with somebody leaving or relationships ending.
Kirsten Corley, would you be so kind to share some with us?
Yes, absolutely. So this one kind of goes into anxiety. You overthink because you care. You worry because you don't want to hurt anybody. You question yourself because people have led you to believe it's you that is flawed. But you should know your heart isn't like the rest of them. You are made to feel a little more. You're made to care a little more. Sadly, that means you're going to get hurt a little more. But keep being you. Keep doing your best because it is enough. You are enough.
So true.
Another one is, but love isn't this. Love is an adrenaline rush of emotions. Love isn't tearing someone apart. Love isn't pain. Love isn't confusion. Love doesn't leave you wondering. Love isn't trying so hard to keep someone's attention. Love is simple. Love is supposed to build you up and not knock you down. Love is supposed to fill you and not leave you empty as you sacrifice parts of yourself to appease them.
Wow. Is there one that your grandmother had said to you once that you wrote down?
There is one. She wasn't my grandmother, but she was a woman I had been visiting at a nursing home. And she was a Holocaust survivor. It was an assignment in college. And I'd met for, it was assignment my sophomore year, and I continued to meet with her for the next 3 years, even after I graduated.
Great
and,
for you.
Yeah, and we had spoken about what it was like to be liberated from a concentration camp. And her exact words were, we were like free birds with broken wings, but we had nowhere to fly. And
so
I wrote
true.
That in my phone at the time. I don't think I even had an iPhone my sophomore year. I just had, I don't know what I had, but I wrote it
flip
in
phone.
There. Yeah, I wrote it in my phone and I said, I don't know what I want to do with this, but I held on to it for the next like 6 years. So I'm happy to have put that in my book also.
Is she still alive?
She is, yes.
Great. Did you share that with her?
Send her a copy of the book? I haven't yet. She has dementia, so it's kind of...
Her family, I'm sure, would love it.
Yeah. I definitely need to take another trip down there and visit her.
That's fantastic. To know that people can hear lines like that and have them reverberate, you know, on so many different levels. And or, just for example, I was at an event about 3 months ago. And I was hosting it, and some guy came up to me. He's like, oh, great job. You know, you can really get the crowd going, exactly, and et cetera, et cetera. And some kid came up to me and, you know, said something, and I talked to him. And he said to me, you're never as tall as when you lean down to help a child. I mean, just a little simple line like that is so emblematic of how important it is for this particular, you know, explanation, obviously, to lend a hand and advice and or assistance to a child. You have another one for us?
Yeah. This one's one I actually heard in a bar. Is
it G or R or X-rated?
Said, if you're proud of the person you are, it's your past mistakes that made you that way.
Absolutely. So true.
Yeah, so I wrote, that was another one I wrote down, and I just held on for years. I didn't
read
even
that
know
again.
The guy.
Read that one again. I love that.
If you're proud of the person you are, it's your past mistakes that made you that way.
Yeah. What bar was that?
It was the local bar in my town, Huddy's.
Oh, nice. Oh, that was at Huddy's? Are you kidding me? I've been there.
It's
oh, my God.
Favorites.
That's hysterical.
That's where I worked in high school.
That's hysterical. Wow. And I love the fact that, you know, you are so active with Covenant House. You have an award that was given to you called Killing It, because obviously you do so much for them. with working with trafficked and homeless youth, both in New York and abroad. I mean, that just says how much you care about individuals, whether it's people with mental illness, people who are just, you know, struggling every day in life. Obviously, and these children are exceptionally exposed to arduous situations.
Yeah, I think the biggest way to deal with my internal problems or the things I struggle with every single day is to help somebody else. So, you know, I channel that a lot into charity work. I channel it a lot into service projects and races and things along those lines, getting as involved as I can with every type of organization I'm involved in.
Where do you see yourself 10 years from now? Do you see yourself writing fiction? Do you see yourself developing a character that's maybe reflective of yourself, that has some sort of mental illness, or going totally in a different direction?
I would say, you know, I haven't really thought about making myself a character. You know, I think...
Well, we all are characters,
yeah.
Right?
So I think in 10 years, you know, I think writing and charity will always be a part of my life. So it's been a great 3 years in New York so far, and it's been interesting to see where I've been so far. So I think those two main things will always be a part of my life. So in 10 years... hopefully, maybe I'll have more of a leadership role when it comes to the charity groups I'm a part of and just progress and learn as much as I can.
I have the name of your charity that you're going to start. It's called Corley Cares.
It's a good name.
It's a good name. I mean, obviously, your family, full disclosure, your father was on here a couple weeks ago. He's a guru in the finance industry and has written a book as well, a totally different topic. But the importance of what we just spoke about come together as obviously as a father and your mother, of course, role models, doing what they need to do, supporting you, giving you love, education, and the opportunity to help you in whatever way you need to grow. And that's so pivotal and allow you to experience things in life. And we fail. You know, parents, as a parent, it's very hard to see when children fail, but sometimes you have to let them do that. Obviously, not in a gargantuan or dangerous way, but life lessons, like you just said, that quote, you learn more from your mistakes than your successes.
Yeah, and you know, it's definitely, I've made a lot of mistakes, but it's definitely nice to know, regardless of what may happen or things I might do wrong, you know, I always have, my parents were kind of that safety net to help me through it and help me to learn some of the things.
And you are to many others.
Yeah.
Have you resolved that this is who you are and this is how you're going to live the rest of your life with anxiety and depression?
Yeah, you know, I just think it's you kind of have to learn how to navigate through it. You know, I'm never going to rid myself of having a bad, depressed day, but it's just waking up and realizing, okay, this might be a day that's kind of tougher for me.
A little longer.
Yeah, it's a little longer. It might seem like this work day is going to drag out a little more, but it's just knowing, okay, this is not who I am. This is who I am on a depressed day. And I think a lot of times when it comes to mental health, we put on a lot of lenses. You know, you put on a depressed lens, you put on an anxious lens, and being able to identify the difference between those definitely helps me to overcome it and realize, okay, this is just a depressed day. This isn't a real day.
And it's invaluable for you to be able to have the wherewithal to be able to put a label on it, to be able to break it down like that, and to realize, yeah, this is who I am today. It's going to be a longer day, possibly. And I'll have to do some self-talks throughout the day, maybe take a walk out at lunch or go in the bathroom and cry, whatever it takes.
Yeah.
But you just know yourself. And it's great when at the young age of 25. I mean, I think my first panic attack, when I look back, a very mild panic attack, and/or depression started about then.
Uh-huh.
That's when my brother died by suicide that year. So I think that's when things started to happen for me.
Uh-huh.
And I want to mention before we go a great article that you wrote, and we don't have time to really discuss it, but I want to bring it to our listeners' attention. The title of the article is "This Is What I Need in a Partner Because of Anxiety." This is on the thoughtcatalog.com, thoughtcatalog.com. If listeners go to Thought Catalog, if they put in your name, it'll go right to the most recent article.
Yeah.
Great. And all the articles, subsequent articles will appear there?
Yeah, there's about 50 pages.
50 pages. That's awesome. That's awesome. So talk about your marathon very quickly.
So I'm going to be running with a bunch of other people Sunday. And, you know, I start off at 10:40. I should be finishing probably around 3:30.
Nice. That's respectable time, Kirsten Corley.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see. So 3:34 is just my goal. Be at the bar by 4:30.
Yes. I love you for more than one reason. One of my most fond memories are running a couple of New York City marathons here, coming off the 59th Street Bridge, going up First Avenue, 2nd Avenue, I mean. And it's just incredible. The euphoric feeling, the crowds, the millions of people who just pull you along.
Yeah, there isn't a race in the world like it. I've done 17 other half marathons and 2 other full marathons, and there isn't one like this.
Kudos to you, Kirsten Corley. Thank you very much for your time and for all that you've done and all that you shared.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm happy to have been here.
Oh, my pleasure. Check out Kirsten Corley on thoughtcatalog.com, thoughtcatalog.com. My name is Mark Farrell. As always, thank you so much for hanging out with me each and every Thursday right here. If you need a great speaker at your school, get somebody else. But if you need me, go to markfarrellmotivation.com, markfarrellmotivation.com for talks on overcoming adversity, anti-bullying, drugs and alcohol, and, of course, mental health. Have a great day. Gary Knowles next.